Well, I'm delighted, honoured and intimidated to be here, to be invited here to talk to this distinguished and well-informed audience. One of the joys of having written this book is it's taken me places that, a bit like the Secret Service itself, I suppose, that you might not normally expect to get to. And it's kind of appropriate, I think, especially appropriate, that I'm talking in this particular place, not just, or perhaps not solely, because David Lloyd George was one of the greatest British Prime Ministers of the last century. Certainly that, and certainly one of the most devious British Prime Ministers of the last century. It's quite a lot of competition, of course, I suppose, for that. But this is one Whitehall Court, and two Whitehall Court was the wartime headquarters, right next door, up the top of the building, of what was then called MI1. C, and is now the Secret Intelligence Service. So we're within touching distance of the history of the service as well. Now, I'm often asked what the big secret of the book was, particularly when we were discussing the launch and the publicists and the publishers, because there was a whole kind of commercial agenda to the commissioning of the history. It was commissioned partly to celebrate the centenary of the organisation, founded in 1909 as the Secret Service Bureau, with a home branch to look after domestic security and a foreign branch to collect intelligence from foreign sources, in that case specifically Germany. The home branch turns into MI5, the security service, and I know Christopher Andrew has already spoken to you, and the foreign branch turns into SIS, so now I follow on to finish the complete the circle, a virtuous circle here of the security and intelligence services, if that's what it is. But the commissioning of the history was not just to celebrate, as it were, commemorate the centenary. It was also part of a continuing openness of the security services. I mean, in the British tradition, until 1994, the security and intelligence services did not officially exist. And in 1994, the Intelligence Services Act said, clause one, I think it is, this act is to establish that there shall continue to be a secret intelligence service. So it didn't establish it then, it merely reflected the fact that it had existed for some time. And between 1994 and today, a whole series of what would have seemed astonishing developments to early servants of the organisation, indeed not so, I mean more recent servants of the organisation, have put it much more in the limelight, varying from the organisation, the most secretive, and perhaps rightly so, the most secretive government department of Britain, moving into one of the most emblematic and identifiable buildings in London, which seems odd, that they have a website, that they have a war artist, an official artist whose pictures we saw in the released yesterday, and a lot of discussions to how revealing or not they might be, and of course commissioning an official history. And in a way, the secret of the book is the book itself, the wholly improbable kind of counterintuitive exercise of this most secretive of organisations commissioning an open history to be openly published and letting an individual independent historian, and we can talk about that too, into the organisation, to be embedded within the organisation for about 5 years in order to write this history, drawing on the archives, such as have survived, of the organisation, which themselves, unlike any other British government department, are never released to the National Archives. There is no intention, I understand, to release any of these documents, and they haven't been released in the past. Not the archives, the, as it were, domestic archives of the service itself. Which is not to say there aren't quite a lot of papers in the National Archives relating to the service or generated by the service, but they will have been released by other government departments, not the service itself. Now, in commissioning the history, the decision was made that it should only look at the first 40 years of the history, 1909 to 1949. And that's been a disappointment to many of the reviewers, because in intelligence terms, 1949 is deep past history. I mean, it's like a sort of, the Jurassic layers of the history of intelligence. And it appears that the history omits altogether the dominating themes of the more recent past, the Cold War, and of course the collapse of the Soviet bloc and the recalibration of security and intelligence agencies to meet new and different challenges in the late 20th century. And Christopher Andrews' official history purports to cover the whole century. Though those of you who have read it, as I have, it's a very good book. I strongly recommend you to buy it. But those of you who have read it will know that it does actually get thinner and thinner and thinner as it comes closer to the four understandable, if not also necessary, reasons. So the decision, the call about what to cover for the Secret Intelligence Service itself, whose activities are themselves more problematic and necessarily more secret than the Security Service. I mean, to put a casual, I mean, one example of this is that what the Security Service does is it remain within the law. They do not break, or they should not break the law. They operate within Britain and they should not break British law. What the Secret Intelligence Service does is inevitably to break laws. Perhaps not British laws, but they will inevitably, by the nature of their operations, break foreign laws. And that immediately makes it a kind of more, puts it on a different plane. And now there are other reasons why you might not want to look at the recent past for this. But the argument was that by going to 1949, the first 40 years of the service, you had two world wars, very important. You had just the beginning of the Cold War, so you could get a little bit of that in. But it was sufficiently far away, sufficiently distant, the terminal point, that as full a story as possible could be told up to that point. And that, I think, was the understanding of the then chief, Sir John Scarlett, who was very much the prime mover within the organisation of this exercise. He was keen that a proper history should be written. He was keen that a professional historian should be brought in from outside. And my own expertise tended to be for the first quarter of the 20th century, First World War, 1920s, done a lot of work on this. And that, of course, covers the early, the first two, if not even three decades of the service. But the corollary to going to 1949, the 31st of December 1949, and being able to tell as full a story up to that, the corollary for that is there's a kind of Chinese wall down. I know nothing about the 1st of January 1950. And were you to ask me a question, I would have to express some ignorance. No, in fact, of course, it's impossible, completely to make a division between one day and the next. But there is a kind of exercise in which I mustn't speculate too extensively over the more recent history of the service. Nevertheless, it is my argument is that the essentials of what was set up and the essentials of the experience of the service and its relationship with government, its functions between 1909 and 1949 covers most of the key issues that might apply to any secret intelligence service, perhaps not just in Britain, but elsewhere as well. So I want to go on to look at some of these themes that run through the book, and you can extrapolate forward if you wish for some of these. I mean, an early and a sort of first question to ask is simply function. What should a secret intelligence service do? And the division of responsibility between the security service, which is is not really an intelligence service, and what became the secret intelligence service was set up, as I've already outlined, from the very beginning. The core business, if you like, of SIS is foreign intelligence from foreign sources. What they want to know about is intentions, capabilities, political information of foreign countries that the foreign countries wish to keep secret. And there's always a tension between the intelligence or information gathering exercises of open, legitimate diplomats, the ambassadors in countries, and these guys from kind of the below the salt, if you like, behind the green baize door, these funnies or spooks or whatever you want to call them, who are operating in the same country and sometimes jeopardizing, of course, the untroubled or good relations that the ambassador might have built up. Nothing, I suppose, an ambassador fears more is that some scandal discover that compatriots have been up to funny business in the country at the same time. And there's no point to the Secret Intelligence Service gathering information that an ambassador can gather perfectly well. And many ambassadors say, well, give me a good journalist, give me good sources, and there's really nothing I can do that some of these false beard types, sleuth types, can't do. And that's a constant tension. Nevertheless, it seems to be the case, and one of the issues that was raised when I was appointed for this, I was interviewed for the job, and I wasn't the only person interviewed, and one of the questions I was asked at the interview was, did I regard this organisation, I'm sitting in that Roxy building in Vauxhall Cross, did I regard this organisation as a successful organisation? Now, there are moments in interviews when you can say the right thing and you can say the wrong thing, and there is one wrong answer to that question. No, a complete waste of time, I'm afraid, you know. So I said, yes, it was a successful organisation, if only in the sense that it survived 40 years. And I would still stick by that that definition of success in a sometimes really very hostile environment, not just overseas, but also domestically, and in an environment where other government departments want to do things you're doing, or other government departments want to take you over, particularly the service ministries, whose needs ebb and flow as changing political and military circumstances of the day. But by 1949, it seems clearly demonstrated that the secret intelligence organisation was meeting perceived needs in Britain and to the British state. Now, it may be just as insurance. We can't afford not to have this. What will go on if we don't have an intelligence service? It may be actually providing hard information at the time or potentially in the future. But when the debate occurred or discussion occurred in 1949, happily for me, in coming to a conclusion in 49, a discussion about who should be the next chief, the fourth chief of the service, and the foreign secretary and the permanent secretary of the Foreign Office agree between them that the most important single job in British intelligence is the head of the Secret Intelligence Service. So that's a kind of validation and imprimatur from the customer departments, who of course also have to pay the money, so sometimes they're a wee bit sceptical about these things. So the function is really important, but the fact that the core business began and more or less remained foreign intelligence from foreign sources is also important. There are times through the history of the service, at the end of the First World War, during the interwar period, when the chief, a man called Sinclair, an admiral who had been head of naval intelligence, and he's a terrific empire builder, and from time to time he offers himself to be the head of a kind of integrated, coordinated intelligence organisation that would include MI6 or SIS, it would include the security service, it would include bits of the special branch of the Metropolitan Police, and there would be a central intelligence agency, even the actual title was used in a couple of documents, and he would be the head of it. And every time this was proposed, and it would go to an interdepartmental committee, and the interdepartmental committee would conclude that if we were starting from scratch, we might well start with an integrated security and intelligence organisation. But because we have inherited this particular institutional structure, it's working well enough, and perhaps we don't want to take the risk of concentrating what would be a tremendous amount of power and potential influence in one organisation. And that having different organisations doing different parts of the security and intelligence spectrum, meeting those needs, was politically desirable. There was another subtext, is that Sinclair was identified as the man most suitable for heading it, and they said, well, we don't really know, it's a really great civil service argument this, we don't really know who we'd find to succeed such a dynamic individual as the head of that organisation, so perhaps we ought to put him in that difficult position. It's a very, very clever argument. But But the fact that it remains, as I say, a core business all the way through, and when Sinclair does briefly, and there is, of course, an area that, in the 1920s when there's a substantial overlap between the Security Service and the Secret Intelligence Service, particularly in combating international communism. So if a communist Comintern agent is coming from Berlin through Belgium to Britain, it's SIS who have to chart those things and then kind of hand it over to the Security Service in Britain, and if they go out again. So there are difficulties there that the opposition don't necessarily confine themselves to convenient domestic and foreign areas of action. Sinclair was so concerned about the feebleness of MI5 between the wars. It was pretty feeble. Christopher Andrew may have given another impression, but at other times it was very good. But he set up his own organisation called the Casuals, which operated a domestic surveillance organisation in Britain under him. And eventually, when it began to rub up against both the Security Service, or what became the Security Service in 1931, up against MI5 and the special branch, the political end of the Metropolitan Police, he got his knuckles wrapped very seriously by the Home Office and had to dismantle this organisation, hand it over to what was then established as a recognisably modern Security Service in 1931. So the function's important. And the other two chiefs who cover this first 40 years of the service, Mansfield Cumming, I mean, extraordinary, charismatic, sort of crazy, lovable figure, who had this flat at 2 Whitehall Court, and about whom a huge mythology built up, which you'll find sketched out in the book. But Mansfield Cumming and Sinclair's successor, who became chief at the beginning of the war, a man called Mingies, Sir Stuart Mingies, spelt Menzies, confusingly pronounced Mingies, not actually for security reasons, but because that's the way the Scots do it. But both Cumming and Mingies, at the end of both the wars over which they had presided over SIS, and when they're being invited to do more political work, party political work, they both say, this is not our job, or we'll only do it, as Mingies said, under direct instruction from the Foreign Office. We must not be tainted by the stamp, I think he put this, or one of his colleagues put it, the stamp of the Gestapo. That's a very difficult area, and that by sticking to our foreign intelligence from foreign sources, it means that we've got a politically an easier ride back home. We're not doing too much, and we're not interfering domestically. And that, perhaps in less well-developed democracies than Britain, that is always a sort of worry about intelligence and security organisations, of course. So function. Another aspect of function is the question of special operations, because covert agencies are frequently employed to do kind of sabotage and subversion and black propaganda. They're not just intelligence gatherers. Now, for most of the period, from the beginning of the service right through to the early or the late 1930s, what SIS does is they gather intelligence. And they just gather it as directed, as required by large by their customer departments, the service ministries, the Foreign Office, sometimes the economic departments of state. Those are the main customer departments. But in the late 1930s, as war seems to become inevitable, inside the service they begin to think about doing all sorts of stuff, and all sorts of stuff which you might associate with a clandestine organisation. They develop a branch called Section D for destruction, some said, which was to specialise in sabotage and propaganda. There's a strikingly contemporary report from the committee in the summer of 1939 in which they speculate on the possibility of Nazi agents going about the underground, dropping sort of bags of anthrax powder in the underground. Now, this has a kind of contemporary resonance in metro systems, not in Britain. They also, and of course, the other wonderful thing about the history is that there's a kind of social history embedded in this as well. You get these flashlights of the past that just beggar one's credulity sometimes. And in this worry about the possibility of biological attacks in Britain, someone had said, well, is the Prime Minister's milk boiled before use, because doorstep milk deliveries can be tampered with. And you have this vision of 10 Downing Street, as some of us, very much the older ones among us, might remember. You could walk into 10 Downing Street, and that every morning express dairies would come along and find that Neville Chamberlain or perhaps Mrs. Chamberlain put out a note saying 2 pints of Gold Top or whatever the Prime Minister had in those days. And here was this kind of notion that they were so naive, we would think, so peaceable was the assumptions then that such a thing could be conceivable. Ah, happy days indeed. But special operations then develop in the Second World War, and the special operations branch of SIS is full of ideas, but it's run by a kind of creative enthusiast who has no ability for organisationing, budget gets badly out of control. And in fact, in 1940, a specialist organisation called Special Operations Executive is set up and runs those kind of operations through the Second World War. And there is sometimes a completely inimical relationship between secret intelligence gathering and special operations. Say you're gathering information from a railway junction, and mapping trains and traffic analysis of trains is really very important. 1941, it matters whether the trains of German troops are going east or going west, for an invasion of Britain or an invasion of somewhere else. And if you can build up a kind of picture, a strategic picture of where these are going, you want lots of people in strategic points on the railway system. But if you're special operations, what you want to do is to blow up those strategic points because they're strategic points. And of course, by doing that, you might rob the service of the intelligence that they're getting, because there'll be a concentration of security at these areas. And so those are the kinds of issues. There's the sorts of things. SOE was invited by Churchill to set Europe ablaze. And by setting bits of Europe ablaze, of course, it could make life very uncomfortable and difficult for the more quieter requirements of clandestine intelligence gathering. So there's a tension between these organisations. Now, sometimes they're incorporated in the same organisation, because what emerges in the American side is the Organisation of Strategic Services, the OSS, which does both things. And successor, the CIA, does both things, and that can produce difficulties. What happens at the end of the Second World War, very interestingly for SIS, is SOE is reabsorbed into SIS. And despite an attempt by Field Marshal Montgomery to take over the Secret Intelligence Service in 1947 or 48, because he says this is a military organisation, we can get by using special military operations instead of using expensive orthodox forces. Here's another debate. This is not new. And he says it would be much more convenient for us to remove the embarrassing possibilities, the potential for embarrassment from the Foreign Office, and we'll take it over in the Ministry of Defence. And now the Foreign Office were quite happy to run the potential embarrassments of having the Secret Intelligence Service and saw off Montgomery. But what happens to SIS for that brief period to which I can look at in the Cold War is that SIS begins to do rather less secret intelligence gathering in the late 1940s and rather more special operations. And that has consequences in the public realm as well as the private realm. One of the operations which I look at, for example, is an operation called Valuable, which is putting in anti-communist expats into Albania in the late 40s. And this is a series of operations that turned disastrously wrong, I understood, but I can't, of course, comment on it after the 31st December 1949. But you can see that some of the approaches to the new Cold War are informed by special operations expertise and special operations experience. Because what both SIS and SOE have done in the war is dealing with occupied territory. And once you've got the Iron Curtain, you've got more occupied territory, and they say, we know about this. We've done this before. We've landed in. We've got internal resistance movements. We know about drugs. drop zones. We can get people in and out of these sorts of things. We've got all these systems ready for us. What they don't really take into account is the seriousness and the extraordinary vicious relentlessness of the security regime that exists within Eastern Europe, which in some cases, astonishingly enough, puts the German occupation regimes in some European countries to shame, and the penetration operations into soft bloc in the late 40s, which continue on to a certain extent, are a failure. So special operations is an interesting area which you have to balance the needs between secret intelligence and special operations. By 1949, and here's another, I'll just drop this out as a potential theme, the Secret Intelligence Service has emerged as essentially a civilian organisation. It begins as a military organisation. It's appointed by the directors of military intelligence and naval intelligence. The first chiefs are long-serving professional soldiers and sailors. The first four chiefs fit into that model. All the chiefs subsequently, though they may have military service, are essentially civilians. They aren't professional career soldiers or sailors. And that partly reflects the fact that the parent department for the organisation is the Foreign Office and not the Armed Services. And there's a difference between intelligence and security organisations which reply to or speak to or run by armed service organisations and those which are not. And the British model is to follow a civilianised one, which doesn't mean that there aren't intelligence branches, of course, in the armed services, but they meet only their particular intelligence needs, and they don't spread out into wider political matters. So civilian principle, as a civilian organisation, is a key principle. Another theme which I follow in the book is the importance of liaison with foreign countries. And this is quite a difficult area because there are points at which Britain's between 1909 and 1949, and particularly in the interwar period, Britain's intelligence officers overseas have to make cozy up to their opposite numbers in foreign capitals. And, for example, you cozy up to the French because you share an anxiety about the Italians in the Mediterranean. The French do, and the Germans in Northwest Europe. And there may be closer reasons for being allied or, you know, having a close liaison with these people, but your friends, your enemy's friend is your enemy as well. You know, you can see these kinds of bilateral relationships building up. They're enormously important in the Second World War, liaison relationships that have been built up in the interwar period. For example, I have a photograph in the book. And one of the problems, despite this war artist guy who's produced his paintings yesterday, in fact, the paintings themselves, of course, reveal nothing. They're only resonant because of what they don't reveal and what they're, you know, is the kind of title and the subtext, what does this really mean kind of thing. Well, I have a photograph in the book which does mean something, and it's a photograph of a summer lunch in 1939 with President Beneš, exiled now of Czechoslovakia, and sitting next to him is the former head of station, SIS head of station in Prague, Harold Gibson. And two down round the table is František Moravec, who's the head of the Czech intelligence service, a military intelligence service, by the way. And what, despite the horrors of Munich and the apparent sort of sacrifice and letting down the Czechs, the essential relationships built up closely between Harold Gibson and his Czech opposite numbers, or Czechoslovak opposite numbers, was sufficiently deep-rooted and sufficiently firm, not only and confirmed by the fact that Gibson, by chartering a plane, manages to get the Czech intelligence high command and most of their central documents out of Prague in 1939 when the Germans walk in, remains a close relationship, and that the Czech intelligence network survives the German occupation of of Czechoslovakia and is a valuable source of information through the Second World War, run from London. And the same sort of thing happens with some other services. To a certain extent, well, the Poles very much so, the French to a certain extent, and some other ones as well. And without those kinds of relationships being built up in different capitals at different times, when you actually need assistance, sometimes they're not available. So liaison. But liaison isn't always understood by the outside world. There is this kind of notion, if I borrow expressions from the novels of John le Carré, with which some of you might be familiar. George Smiley is the chief English-British spymaster. His opposite number in the Soviet Union is Karla, and the sort of argument that Smiley and Karla have more in common with each other than with the governments they serve is a kind of trope theme of espionage novels and films and all the rest of it. So there is that danger of how this might be perceived. Frank Foley, who's the head of station in Berlin before the Second World War, saint-like figure who, as passport control officer, pushes to the limits his allowances for passing out passports, particularly to Jewish people coming out of Germany. But he also, in the mid-1930s, is very, very close to the Gestapo, because he shares an apprehension with the Gestapo as to the abilities and the capabilities and the extent of a Soviet communist subversion and penetration of the West. So, and in there, there's a book written a few years ago about Foley, which rather celebrates, of course, his the good Gentile side in helping Jews, but rather passes over in silence his closeness to the Gestapo at one side or another. So, but these are both essential needs at different times. So I've just here are a few themes which may resonate in the future. And sometimes, again, when I'm asked, what's the important big story of the book, and I say, well, chapter 18, you may not have got that far if indeed you've seen the book yet, available in all good bookshops, chapter 18, which is called Post-War Planning, and the publishers, I kept saying this is a really important chapter, and they were saying, quite difficult to sell, they wanted the real James Bond, and a bit of derring do, and sort of glamorous female spies, they're all in there, sure, but Post-War Planning is about the end of the Second World War and the organisation as it emerges professionalised in the mid to late 1940s. And people who served long in the service, whom I'd met from the 50s, 60s, who went back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, say, or one of them certainly said to me, that the organisation that is established by that post-war planning that's covered in chapter 18 is recognisably the organisation that he had joined in the 1970s. So you can't stop necessarily or crudely at the 31st December 1949. And the official history is not perhaps just about past history, but since it addresses some of the constants of intelligence activity, it might also speak to the present, if not also the future. Thank you.